the Willy Walla in the passage between the shore reef and the outer reef. From the latter came the low murmur of a lazy surf, but the sheltered stretch of water, not more than 100 yards across to the white beach of pounded coral sand, was of glass-like smoothness, narrow as was the passage, and anchored, as she was, in the shoeless place that gave room to swing. The Willy Walla's chain rode up and down a clean 100 feet. Its course could be traced over the bottom of living coral. Like some monstrous snake, the rusty chain slack wandered over the ocean floor, crossing and recrossing itself several times, and fetching up finally at the idle anchor, big rock caught, done and mottled, played warily in and out of the coral. Other fish, grotesque of form and color, were brazenly indifferent, even when a big fish shark drifted sluggishly along and sent the rock caught scuttling for their favorite crevices on deck. Forward, a dozen blacks pottered clumsily at scraping the deck rail. They were as inexpert at their work as so many monkeys. In fact, they looked very much like monkeys of some enlarged and prehistoric type. Their eyes had in them the querulous plaintiveness of the monkey, their faces were even less symmetrical than the monkey's, and, hairless of body, they were far more ungarmented than any monkey, for clothes they had none. Decorated they were as no monkey ever was. In holes in their ears they carried short clay pipes, rings of turtle shell, huge plugs of wood, rusty wire nails, and empty rifle cartridges. The caliber of a Winchester rifle was the smallest hole an ear bore. Some of the largest holes were inches in diameter, and any single ear averaged from 3 to 6 holes. Spikes and buttons of polished bone or petrified shell were thrust through their noses. On the chest of one hung a white doorknob, on the chest of another the handle of a china cup, on the chest of a third the brass cogwheel of an alarm clock. They chattered in queer, falsetto voices, and, combined, did no more work than a single white sailor. Aft, under an awning, were two white men. Each was clad in a sixpenny undershirt, and wrapped about the loins with a strip of cloth. Belted about the middle of each was a revolver and tobacco pouch. The sweat stood out on their skin in myriads of globules. Here and there the globules coalesced in tiny streams that dripped to the heated deck, and almost immediately evaporated. The lean, dark-eyed man wiped his fingers wet with a stinging stream from his forehead, and flung it from him with a weary curse. Wearily, and without hope, he gazed seaward across the outer reef, and at the tops of the palms along the beach. 8 o'clock, and hell don't get hot till noon, he complained. Wish to God for a breeze. Ain't we never going to get away? The other man, a slender German, of 25, with a massive forehead of a scholar, and the tumble-home chin of a degenerate, did not trouble to reply. He was busy emptying powdered quinine into a cigarette paper. Rolling what was approximately 50 grains of the drug into a tight wad, he tossed it into his mouth, and gulped it down without the aid of water. Wished I had some whiskey, the first man panted. After a 15-minute interval of silence, another equal period elapsed ere the German announced, relevant of nothing, I'm rotten with fever, I'm going to quit you, Griffiths, when we get to Sydney. No more tropics for me. I ought to known better when I signed on with you. You ain't been much of a mate, Griffiths replied, too hot himself to speak heatedly. When the beach at Govita heard I'd shipped you, they all laughed. What, Jacobson? They said, you can't hide a square face of Trajan, or sulfuric acid, that he won't smell out. You've certainly lived up to your reputation. I ain't had a drink for a fortnight. What of your snoop in my supply? If the fever was as rotten in you as me, you'd understand, the mate whimpered. I ain't kickin', Griffiths answered. I only wish God had sent me a drink, or a breeze of wind, or something. I'm ripe for my next chill tomorrow. The mate proffered him the quinine. Rolling a 50-grain dose, he popped the wad into his mouth, and swallowed it dry. God, God, he moaned, I dream of a land somewheres where they ain't no quinine. Damned stuff of hell, I've scoffed tons of it in my time. Again he quested seaward for signs of wind. The usual trade wind clouds were absent, and the sun, still low in its climb to meridian, turned all the sky to heated brass. One seemed to see as well as feel this heat, and Griffiths sought vain relief by gazing shoreward. The white beach was a searing ache to his eyeballs. The palm trees, absolutely still, outlined flatly against the unrefreshing green of the packed jungle, seemed so much cardboard scenery. The little black boys, playing naked in the dazzle of sand and sun, were an affront, and a hurt to the sunsick man. He felt a sort of relief when one, running, tripped and fell on all fours in the tepid seawater. An exclamation from the black's full roar sent both men glancing seaward. Around the near point of land, a quarter of a mile away, and skirting the reef, a long black canoe paddled into sight. "Guma boys from the next bite," was the mate's verdict. One of the blacks came aft, treading the hot deck with the unconcern of one whose bare feet felt no heat. This, too, was a hurt to Griffiths, and he closed his eyes, but the next moment they were open wide. "White fella marster stop along Guma boy," the black said. Both men were on their feet and gazing at the canoe. Aft could be seen the unmistakable sombrero of a white man. Quick alarm showed itself on the face of the mate. "It's grief," he said. Griffith satisfied himself by a long look, then ripped out a wrathful oath. "What's he doing up here?" he demanded of the mate, of the aching sea and sky, of the merciless blaze of sun, and of the whole superheated and implacable universe with which his fate was entangled. The mate began to chuckle. "I told you couldn't get away with it," he said. But Griffiths was not listening. With all his money coming around like a rent collector, he chanted his outrage, almost in an ecstasy of anger. "He's loaded with money, he's stuffed with money, he's busting with money. I know for a fact he sold his Iringa plantations for £300,000. Bell told me so himself last time we were drunk at Govita, worth millions and millions, and shylocking me for what he wouldn't light his pipe with." He whirled on the mate. "Of course you told me so. Go on and say it, and keep on saying it. Now just what was it you did tell me so?" "I told you didn't know him. If you thought you could clear the Solomons without paying him, that man Grief is a devil, but he's straight. I know. I told you he'd throw £1,000 away for the fun of it. And for sixpence fight, like a shark for a rusty tin. I tell you I know. Didn't he give his Balakula to the Queensland Mission when they lost their Evening Star on San Cristobal? And the Balakula worth £3,000, if she was worth a penny, and didn't he beat up Struthers till he lay abed a fortnight, all because of a difference of £2.10 in the account, and because Struthers got fresh and tried to make the gouge go through? God strike me blind." Griffiths cried in impotency of rage. The mate went on with his exposition. "I tell you only a straight man can buck a straight man like him, and the man's never hit the Solomons that could do it. Men like you and me can't buck him. We're too rotten all the way through. You've got plenty more than £1,200 below. Pay him, and get it over with." But Griffiths gritted his teeth and drew his thin lips tightly across them. "I'll buck him," he muttered more to himself and the brazen ball of sun than to the mate. He turned and half started to go below, then turned back again. "Look here, Jacobson, he won't be here for a quarter of an hour. Are you with me? Will you stand by me?" "Of course I'll stand by you. I've drunk all your whiskey, haven't I? What are you going to do?" "I'm not going to kill him if I can help it, but I'm not going to pay. Take that flat." Jacobson shrugged his shoulders in calm acquiescence to fate, and Griffith stepped to the companionway and went below, too. Jacobson watched the canoe across the low reef as it came abreast and passed on to the entrance of the passage. Griffiths, with ink marks on right thumb and forefinger, returned on deck 15 minutes later. The canoe came alongside. The man with the sombrero stood up. "Hello, Griffiths," he said. "Hello, Jacobson." With his hand on the rail, he turned to his dusky crew. "You fella boys stop along canoe altogether." As he swung over the rail and stepped on deck, a hint of cat-like litheness showed in the apparently heavy body. Like the other two, he was scantily clad. The cheap undershirt and white loincloth did not serve to hide the well-put-up body. Heavy-muscled he was, but he was not lumped and hummocked by muscles. They were softly rounded, and, when they did move, slid softly and silkily under the smooth, tan skin. Ardent suns had likewise tanned his face, till it was swarthy as a Spaniard's. The yellow mustache appeared incongruous in the midst of such swarthiness, while the clear blue of the eyes produced a feeling of shock on the beholder. It was difficult to realize that the skin of this man had once been fair. "Where did you blow in from?" Griffiths asked, as they shook hands. "I thought you were over in the Santa Cruz." "I was," the newcomer answered, "but we made a quick passage. The wonder's just around in the bight at Guma, waiting for wind. Some of the bushmen reported a catch here, and I just dropped around to see." "Well, how goes it?" "Nothing much. copper sheds mostly empty, and not half a dozen tons of ivory nuts. The women all got rotten with fever and quit, and the men can't chase them back into the swamps. They're a sick crowd. I'd ask you to have a drink, but the mate finished off my last bottle. I wish to God for a breeze of wind. Grief, glancing with keen carelessness from one to the other, laughed. I'm glad the calm held, he said. It enabled me to get around to see you. My supercargo dug up that little note of yours, and I brought it along. The mate edged politely away, leaving his skipper to face his trouble. I'm sorry, Grief. Damn sorry, Griffiths said, but I ain't got it. You'll have to give me a little more time. Grief leaned up against the companionway, surprise and pain depicted on his face. It does beat hell, he communed. How men learn to lean the Solomons. The truth's not in them. Now take Captain Jensen. I'd sworn by his truthfulness. Why, he told me only 5 days ago. Do you want to know what he told me? Griffiths licked his lips. Go on. Why, he told me that you'd sold out everything, cleaned up, and was pulling out for the New Hebrides. He's a damned liar, Griffiths cried hotly.